You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the September 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of the issue's cover story, Jenna Ortega's Year of Wonder by Tom Craig. Ortega received a crash course in online celebrity media, the way a few incendiary quotes are plucked from a lengthy interview and circulated feverishly around the internet. "Everything that I said felt so magnified. It felt almost dystopian to me," she remembers. "I felt like a caricature of myself." The predicament taught her a lesson it takes some women decades longer to learn. You're never going to please everybody, and as someone who naturally was a people pleaser, that was really hard for me to understand, she says. "Some people just may not like you, and that's entirely fine. In fact, I got sick of myself last year," Ortega says, making me laugh. "My face was everywhere. So it's like, fair enough. If I were opening my phone and I saw the same girl with some stupid quote or something, I would be over it too. I offer my unsolicited opinion that even after a social movement urging women to advocate for themselves swept Hollywood, when one such woman isn't a mere silent set piece, the response from some corners remains, how dare she? And further, that as a young Latina, Ortega is doubly expected to profess gratitude and luck to be in her position, but not seek to gain any material power from it, even when, as she noted, the show hinges on her image. I agree with that entirely, Ortega says. I feel like we definitely need to practice what we preach a little bit more. We consider that a young male thespian, going method and deeply in his feels, would be given more license to ride for the integrity of his character. Women have to be princesses, Ortega says. They have to be elegant and classy and so kind, and then when they're outspoken, they can't be tamed, and they're a mess. For the second season, Ortega is getting her wish. She serves as a producer on Wednesday, which began filming in Dublin a few weeks before our interview in May. Now Ortega is empowered to give notes, whether about prosthetics or Wednesday's furiously dramatic cello pieces. Things like that I live for, Ortega beams. For Burton, Ortega's frankness is an asset. She's very direct. She's very no-nonsense. And I find that very refreshing and beautiful and artistic. So sharp, he says, she could direct it if she wanted to, adding, I saw from day one she's very aware. She's more aware sometimes than I am. The newly minted producer promises the show's sophomore season will boast new villains, new supernatural abilities, and an even darker tone. I think the feel that we're going for is a little bit more horror-inspired, Ortega says. Citing The Mask of the Red Death, the 1964 film based on an Edgar Allan Poe short story, as an inspiration. Not to say that suddenly we're the goriest show of all time, Ortega qualifies. I mean, they're six-year-olds watching. She teases an example. We're doing this thing now where Wednesday just kind of appears. She is a little bit of a jump scare herself. Wednesday's second season also promotes Ortega's on-screen parents, Catherine Zeta-Jones as Morticia and Luis Guzman as Gomez, to series regulars, delivering on hints that Morticia and Wednesday will more deeply explore their fraught mother-daughter relationship. I have so much respect for that woman, Ortega says of CZJ. She's just a good, cool person. She doesn't overthink anything. She doesn't take herself too seriously. But she definitely relishes in the drama of things, which, for a character like Morticia, it's perfect. Chief among the show's new cast members, Steve Buscemi, the most perfect classic man per Ortega, with whom she'll appear in Clara and the Sun. I remember I walked into the hair and makeup trailer, and the man in me was playing by Bob Dylan. And Steve turned around, and everything went in slow motion, she laughs, with glimmers of the Big Lebowski dancing in her head. Noticeably absent from the season 2 cast list is Percy Hines White, who starred as Nevermore's brooding artistic Dylan McKay equivalent, Xavier Thorpe, one-third of Wednesday's on-screen love triangle, and the guy who seemed to peer into her tortured soul. In January 2023, a woman on Twitter accused Hines White of sexually assaulting her while she was intoxicated and alleged he threw parties where he assaulted underage girls after giving them drugs and alcohol. Additional allegations later surfaced via Twitter. Hines White denied the rumors and claimed a campaign of misinformation against him online. Losing Hines White has been a weird redirect, but we're introducing so many different characters that I think it kind of will get lost, Ortega says. Wednesday's world does feel slightly askew anyway. Ortega is not succumbing to fears of a sophomore slump. There's definitely the pressure of, oh, I have to get this right. As holy as she inhabited Wednesday after a 2-year hiatus, in part due to the strikes, Ortega found it strange at first, jumping back in. Once she stepped into the character's sharply tailored striped Nevermore uniform, however, Ortega leans forward, her fingertips fluttering up the front of her body, like a spell coming over her. She was Wednesday, all over again. Before her 5th birthday, Ortega asked her mom if she could dye her black hair blonde, so she could look like Cinderella. I did not understand the problem with that, because to me that was who was cool and interesting and beautiful and powerful, she says. As Wednesday, Ortega gives girls of color a heroine who plays deliciously against type, a moody, deadpan Latina, as the Los Angeles Times coined her, and Aubrey Plaza after the duo's dryly funny Screen Actors Guild Awards presenting gig, an antidote to the prototypically sassy, hypersexual drama queen. It's not entirely clear to Ortega why Netflix sought out a Latina actor, other than that it had yet to be done. Both Wednesday and Ortega have since been alternately celebrated as shining examples of Latina representation and critiqued as somehow not Latina enough. The character's heritage is nebulous, mainly communicated through Guzman's occasional sprinkling of Spanish. But some online critics deemed Wednesday's identity undercooked, nothing more than a meaningless treat. Ortega, for one, appreciates the subtlety. That Wednesday's Latinness is not being shoved down your throat. There's nothing worse than when they have the side Mexican character who's carrying the flag on their shoulder, she says. We're so much more than that. Off-screen, too, Ortega reckons with the moving target of representation. She grew up smashing piñatas and making tamales at Christmas with her Mexican-American Puerto Rican family. But then, oftentimes, you're just not good enough, she says. Because I wasn't born in a Spanish-speaking country, I know people have a hard time connecting with me. Ortega doesn't speak Spanish fluently, nor does her father, but it was her mother's first language. I'm so jealous every time I hear my mom speak perfect Spanish. At the Dior show at Paris Fashion Week last September, a video shows Anya Taylor-Joy, who spent her early years in Buenos Aires, introducing her husband to Ortega and a Spanish pop star, Rosalia, in Spanish, and Ortega replying in English. Snark ensued. It stung to be deemed an imperfect representation of a culture to which Ortega herself wishes she were more connected. I think there's a part of me that carries a bit of shame, she says. For a second, I was almost nervous to speak about my family's background because I feel like I was made to feel like it wasn't. She stops short before saying valid or some variation thereof. Ortega wants to become more in touch with her roots, to learn more from her tias who immigrated to the United States, who were told not to speak Spanish as school children so as not to stand out. But also, something that I'm learning is it's not my job to carry the weight of everybody who's ever had that experience Ortega says firmly. Nor should language or birth country define her identity, especially when assimilation is as Latin an experience as anything. Wednesday is cited as proof that casting Latinx actors can pay dividends. According to a recent McKinsey & Company study, the Latinx community turns out in reliably higher numbers than other groups at the movies, especially for horror movies. Is it the Catholicism, Ortega and I wonder? The sense of spirituality, but remains underrepresented on and off screen. It's something that I feel like has not made it through studios' heads, she says. There needs to be a little more faith in what we bring to the table. Maybe that means all of us banding together a little bit more and creating these projects for ourselves, she adds, sounding like a future executive producer. Ortega points to Hollywood's roster of Latin talent, from Pedro Pascal and Plaza to Rachel Ziegler and her Scream co-star Melissa Barrera. I would love to be able to craft stories that show how powerful we can be. Ortega's heritage manifests in her political impulses. She maligns the conservative anti-immigrant paradigm as the possibility of a second Trump presidency looms. It's so corny, but in terms of the land of the free, home of the brave, Mexican people are considered a risk, she says. Even the term alien is insane when we're speaking about human beings. At a pub in Dublin recently, while her friends were drunk in the corner, Ortega struck up a conversation with a bouncer about the country's political and economic climb. Did he know who you were? No, Ortega whispers gleefully. Ortega has posted in support of Palestine in what is an increasingly tense moment in Hollywood. Barrera was fired from the seventh installment of the Scream franchise over her post likening Gaza to a concentration camp. We have zero tolerance for anti-Semitism or the incitement of hate in any form, including false references to genocide, ethnic cleansing, Holocaust distortion, or anything that flagrantly crosses the line into hate speech, a Scream 7 production company responded in a statement. Ortega refuses to be stifled. The business that we work in is so touchy-feely, she says. Everybody wants to be politically correct, but I feel like in doing that, we lose a lot of our humanity and integrity because it lacks honesty. Ortega's experiencing a rush of thoughts now. I wish that we had a better sense of conversation. Imagine if everyone could say what they felt and not be judged for it, and if anything, it sparked some sort of debate, not an argument. She cocks her head to one side as if a thought bubble has appeared. Am I describing world peace? Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice is the splashy first step in Ortega's next act, movie star. And while Halloween-friendly content made her, Ortega's choices indicate she's pushing herself. Of course I'm fearful of being typecast, she admits. She'll star as the titular robot, or artificial friend, in director Taika Waititi's adaptation of Kazuo Ishiguro's futuristic sci-fi novel Clara and the Sun. After reading the book, I felt that Clara was maybe a white robot, Waititi tells me. But after I started developing the script, I felt that in order for her to feel more out of place, that I wanted someone of color. A lunch meeting with Ortega sealed it. As ever, she brought a lot of ideas to the table, Waititi recalled, and she had binge-read Ishiguro. Jenna's very young, Waititi says, but I considered her to be an old soul. Ortega calls the dramedy a complete trust fall in Taika's arms. She says they shot five different versions of the movie, with Waititi rewriting the script all along. He would walk into the trailer, and I would be reading the lines, and he would go, "Oh, darling, throw those away." She went to work every day feeling sick to my stomach with fear over how this was going to turn out. but that was exciting to me. Watiti, however, never doubted her. She would often make me very emotional watching her because it was all very believable. It's a hard thing to play a robot. But Ortega made Clara feel viscerally human. She killed it. In A24's Death of a Unicorn, Ortega's Ridley and her dad, played by Paul Rudd, crash into the mythical creature en route to Rudd's company crisis management summit. The dark comedy, an indie that received special permission to continue filming during the SAG-AFTRA strike last summer, reminds me of a Charlie Kaufman-esque situation, where it's self-deprecating and it's based in the real world, but with some unexplainable variables, she says. It's magical and mysterious, and why would you not want to do a movie for 2 hours about unicorns? Especially with National Treasure Rudd, the most lovable, charismatic, dorky guy. He instantly makes you feel at ease. Earlier this year, Ortega sharply pivoted from teen family fare with the erotic thriller Miller's Girl, adopting the role of an 18-year-old high school student circling a sexual relationship with her teacher, played by Martin Freeman. Viewers and critics seized on the three-decade age gap between Ortega and Freeman, 52, expressing discomfort at a fantasy scene in which their characters simulate sex. Freeman has said his performance was not an endorsement of the relationship, and Ortega agrees. It's not supposed to be a comfortable movie. It's supposed to be awful at times, she tells me now. Art isn't always meant to be pleasant or happy, and everyone skips off into the sunset at the end. We all have effed-up experiences at one point or another. Ortega is still contending with the celebrity sphere as her IMDb credits grow. It's uncharacteristic for an actor her age, but she seldom snapped in paparazzi photos. She's yet to trot out a starry romantic relationship either, though she does understand why famous people date famous people. So few others understand. I don't plan on speaking about my love life publicly, because that's mine, she says. Ortega sees it as a distraction from her work. When you know too much about someone's personal life, then you watch films and you can only see them, the celebrity version of them. There's nothing worse. At the moment, Ortega claims she isn't concealing anything especially glamorous. She spends much of her time either traveling or working. I live on sound stages pretty much, so it's so rare that I'm out seeing the sun. Lately, though, Ortega is slowly beginning to accept that her life is forever changed, and that it's likely to change again, many times. There's so much about the pressure that is put on this line of work that I do, that it's laughable and it's beautiful and it's awful, sometimes all at once, she says. Coffee's drained, we emerge from the darkness of velvet and into the Corinthia's lobby in full bloom on the eve of the Chelsea Flower Show. Ortega slings her black bag over her shoulder and heads out into the light. Paris When It Sizzled by Keziah Weir. In 1973, five American designers and 36 models descended on the City of Light for what would become an era-defining fashion show. And with them was photographer Bill Cunningham. Here, an exclusive look at his treasure trove of largely unseen photos published together for the first time. Opening photo. Bon voyage. Bethan Hardison and a fellow model arrive at Versailles. In more photos, designer Stephen Burrows makes adjustments to a model backstage. As Bill Cunningham wrote in his diary, Bonjour Paris, Sunday morning, November 24th, 1973, the gorgeous mosaic of 36 models arrived from JFK, New York City, and went straight to the Place de Versailles. They had zero awareness about the victory that was to come. Photographs in this article are reprinted from the Battle of Versailles by Mark Bozek, published by Rizzoli, New York. Photos, copyright Bill Cunningham. In 1770, the wedding reception of Marie Antoinette and the Dauphin inaugurated the frescoed and gilded royal opera at the Palace of Versailles, then the largest performance venue in France. A decadent celebration of what turned out to be, for the French monarchy, the beginning of the end. Just a powdered and perfumed hair over 200 years later, what photographer Bill Cunningham described in his diary as the miniature blue, gold, and pink opera house of carved wood, again served as backdrop to an occasion of glittering excess and cultural shift. A much-photographed, unlikely interrogation of race and class. Presented anew in Rizzoli's The Battle of Versailles, the fashion showdown of 1973. Compiled by Mark Bozek, who became acquainted with Cunningham's archives while making his 2018 feature documentary, The Times of Bill Cunningham, the book collects the shots by that beloved chronicler of American fashion, many of them previously unpublished, alongside those of his French counterpart and friend Jean-Louis Serret. The collection offers a lively and multifaceted glimpse of the moment that, as model Pat Cleveland puts it in her introduction to the book, the Americans captured fashion leadership from the city of Paris. Cleveland was one of 36 models who arrived at Orly on the morning of Sunday, November 24th, fresh-faced and punchy from JFK, and ready to compete in an opulent charity fashion show that would pit five French designers against five Americans. For the former, Yves Saint Laurent, Pierre Cardin, Emmanuel Ungaro, Marc Bohan for Christian Dior, and Hubert de Givenchy, with performances by Rudolf Nureyev, Jane Birkin, and Josephine Baker. For the latter, performances by Liza Minnelli, bookended presentations by Oscar de la Renta, Stephen Burrows, Bill Blass, Anne Klein, and a volatile Halston, who, as the critic Robin Given recalled in her erudite and entertaining 2015 book on the occasion, had recently begun narrating himself in the third person and proceeded to yell, "Halston is leaving," as he crashed out of a rehearsal. The pomp and personalities were ripe for Cunningham, whom Cleveland remembers as being like Fellini with a still camera, and who referred to himself not as a photographer, but rather a fashion historian. Bill could charm you into wanting to have your picture taken, whether you felt like it or not, Minnelli writes in her foreword to the book. His photographs are poetry in motion, singing the symphony of the streets and the secret whisperings of the soirees. And what whisperings! In his diary, scanned pages of which appear in this collection, Cunningham describes the multi-day event. From the model's arrival, they had zero awareness about the victory that was to come, to the pre-game celebration luncheon at Maxim's, and the post-show hall of mirrors dinner, at which the great parquet floors were set with tables covered in 2,000 yards of specially woven royal blue cloth and fleur-de-lis. the butter molded into beehives, with Napoleon's signet royal bee spurting out of the top, and the guest attended by an army of servants, meticulously wigged and dressed in the 18th century tradition. "I wasn't interested in food," Cleveland notes. "I was too busy looking at the men in tights." Afterward, the most aristocratic women were seen swirling over the parquet floors at 3:30 in the morning. But as one's memory shifted through the extravagant events, it was the scene of the fashion triumph, the show in the little gold opera house, that lingered. Cunningham recounts with giddy disgust the French designers' overproduced numbers, with set designs that aspired to fairy tale, but turned out to be a poor imitation of the Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade, culminating in a rocket taking off into the ceiling with clouds of sparks and smoke, filling the beautiful auditorium and causing many of the exquisite to gag, the better to juxtapose the pared-down modernity of the Americans, who, thanks to ill-fitting sets, showcased their designs on an all-but-empty stage, opening on Minnelli's rendition of Bonjour Paris, as models and dancers swirled in shades of beige and brown day clothes from each of the five designers. It sparked a love affair, racing back and forth from the stage to the audience, Cunningham wrote, and the models ran off the stage crying, "They love us." From that auspicious opening, the previously competitive American designers settled into a spirit of family cooperation. Notably, more than a quarter of the models were black, with Cleveland starring in Klein's segment, Billy Blair in De Laurentiis, and Beth Ann Hardison in Burroughs class standout, in which form-fitting jersey dresses and stripped ostrich feather headdresses brought down the house. As Cunningham wrote, everyone in the audience realized they were seeing something they had never seen before. And more photos. Trunk show. Pat Cleveland strikes a pose at Orly Airport. On the town, the American models land in Paris. A contingent from the fashion crew strolls a flea market. Alva Chin, Cleveland, Charlene Dash, Barbara Jackson, and Jennifer Bryce in Anne Klein's designs. Battle Royale. Karen Bjornsson McDonald takes a twirl. Showgoers to see and be seen. Tanya Dennis and Liza Minnelli loll on a Versailles bed. Ramona Saunders and Chin in Burroughs designs. The American models on their stripped backstage. The French end with a bang. CZ Guest and John Fairchild. Givenchy's presentation. The scene was so fresh, so wholesome, wrote Cunningham of the Americans in his diary, and the clothes so realistic they captured the hearts of the French women. Marissa Berenson and Francois-Marie Bonnier. Saunders poses with a pair of footmen, Minnelli and Princess Grace of Monaco. Belle Époque. American audience members, including Fairchild and Tom Fallon, Halston chats with Andy Warhol and Nancy North. American models celebrate with Minnelli. The first models off the scene, wrote Cunningham, ran backstage crying, "They love us. They love us." Consider the End. No one knows candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s problematic history better than his family. Joe Hagan talks to that reluctant inner circle about Kennedy's past and the stakes for America's future. And the listener should realize that this article went to press before President Joe Biden dropped out. Opening photo, cheaper by the dozen. Ethel and Robert F. Kennedy Sr. with nine of their children in 1966. 20 years ago, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. appeared in an HBO documentary about the dangers of a nuclear plant on the Hudson River. Indian Point, Imagining the Unimaginable, directed by his sister Rory Kennedy, pits the crusading Kennedys, pictured flying in a helicopter over the nuclear facility against Entergy, the power company. The film argued that the surrounding environment would be made uninhabitable if the plant came under terrorist attack. This was necessarily a high-stakes confrontation. In anticipation, Rory warned her production team they had a potential liability. Her brother, though a prominent and successful environmental lawyer known for suing polluters, could be fast and loose with the facts. He can say some crazy shit, she told them, according to a person involved in the film. Kennedy's interviews had to be thoroughly fact-checked, even though he might come across as an expert, she said. That's who he is. Sure enough, the film had already been edited when producers discovered that Kennedy's interviews were littered with inflated and inaccurate claims, rendering portions of the film unusable. It was like, holy shit, says another source, familiar with events. We have to get the audio and cut certain things out. We can't really say this. You can be sued. The experience of having to tear the film apart and re-edit it was deeply frustrating for Rory, especially because HBO had wanted more Bobby, not less. When her brother gave a speech at the film's premiere, wowed audience members asked Rory why she hadn't included some of his more dramatic points in her film. She couldn't tell them it was because they were untrue. Long before he entered the 2024 race with a wagon train of conspiracy theories, the wider Kennedy family was intimately familiar with RFK Jr.'s problematic personality, the outsized confidence masquerading as expertise, the savior complex, as one family member called it, that drives him to take up quixotic causes and cast himself as a lone hero against established powers, and above all, as one old friend calls it, his pathological need for attention. A few months ago, I began talking to Kennedy family members and close friends, some on the record, others on background, to get insights into the man they know well and to ask some pointed questions. Rather than merely rubber-stamping President Joe Biden's already fatally faltering campaign, shouldn't you be telling voters what you know about your brother and cousin, whose candidacy threatens to swing the presidential election to Donald Trump and upend American history forever? With the future of the country riding on the narrowest of polling margins, shouldn't you be describing in fine detail the acute dangers of the person you know so well before your own family's tragedy becomes the nation's? To describe the family as reluctant is an understatement. Behind the scenes, his siblings, especially brothers Max, Chris, and Joseph II, are furious over his candidacy. Sisters Carrie and Rory are heartbroken. But the desire to preserve their relationship with their brother, combined with the long-standing Kennedy blood oath to protect the family reputation, as someone close to the family described their loyalty, has prevented them from pulling back the curtain on the RFK Jr. they know, instead choosing to focus on policy differences. The Kennedy campaign did not respond to detailed questions from Vanity Fair. After initially denouncing his candidacy last summer, most of the 105 Kennedy relatives, including Bobby's eight siblings, the largest branch of the family, had hoped his campaign would collapse under the weight of his many bizarre claims and alliances with anti-vax cranks and Trump world figures like Steve Bannon and Tucker Carlson. Instead, the family has played defense, going public only when Kennedy's statements went so far out of bounds they had no choice, like when he suggested COVID was ethnically targeted to spare Jewish and Chinese people, or his claim that anti-vaxxers suffered worse oppression than Anne Frank, a statement Sister Carrie called sickening and destructive, or when he claimed there was a mysterious alternative shooter in the death of his father in 1968. Going so far as to interview Sirhan B. Sirhan in prison and proclaim him innocent, or that the CIA was possibly involved in the assassination, claims that caused deep pain for his siblings. Their private efforts to get Bobby to drop out, or at least wait until 2028 to run, have also come to naught. I've spoken to Bobby about this race, about what's at stake, about the importance of supporting Joe Biden, of the impact of the Trump presidency on our country and on the world. Carrie Kennedy, who leads the nonprofit Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights and is disciplined in how she speaks of her brother, tells me, and I was clearly unpersuasive. Asked to share insight into her brother's motives and psychology, she begs off. Well, you need to have a degree, which I don't have. Loyalty has always been the highest virtue in a family that has lived for decades under the public microscope. Stories of Ethel Kennedy keeping ancient friends in her social orbit for favors performed decades earlier are legend. Speaking out is verboten, but the genteel approach has made it easy for RFK Jr. to dismiss them and even to suggest there is a sizable faction of supporters in their ranks, though in truth only one other cousin, Anthony Shriver, has publicly backed him. When 50 Kennedy family members, including the branch known as Generation 3, or G3, appeared on the lawn of the White House with Biden on St. Patrick's Day, it was supposed to be a powerful show of solidarity. But the event was a compromise among people who didn't necessarily agree about what to do, says a person involved. A month later, a public event in Philadelphia generated a series of choreographed videos of the cousins voicing support for Biden. But it had no discernible effect on RFK Jr.'s polling numbers, even as the cousins, to prove their strategy was working, clung to a single poll showing Kennedy would take more votes from Trump than Biden. Other pollsters, like John Della Volpe at the Institute of Politics at Harvard's Kennedy School, say the opposite. Since then, Kennedy has managed to get his name on the ballot in the swing state of Michigan and is spending millions in other states to do the same. A few Kennedy cousins have pushed for a more aggressive approach, with one mockingly referring to the White House photo op as the leprechaun event. Behind the scenes, there is a growing panic that the family must do more to prevent their rogue cousin from causing a political disaster, especially in the wake of Biden's debate performance. As one family intimate, Andy Karsh, who has known Kennedy since 1972, has put it to Bobby directly, if Trump is elected, you'll go down as one of the great villains in American history. Bobby risked damaging the legacies of both his father and uncle at a time when those values and ideals could not be any more important, Karsh tells me. The portrait family members paint of Bobby is of a man of exceptional charm, wit, brains, and generosity, who has championed important environmental causes, but whose worst traits, an unnerving ease with blending fact and fiction, a powerful ability to deny the collateral damage of his own destructive actions, have engulfed his better angels. The source of these pathologies, they observe, are found in his long and troubling biography, a life story marked by personal trauma and addiction to drugs, sex, and perhaps most perniciously of all, public adulation. You can't reason with addiction, says Stephen Kennedy Smith, a cousin of Kennedy's, whose father ran the elder Bobby Kennedy's 1968 presidential campaign. And what we know about addiction is it leads to bad judgment, extremely bad judgment. Next photo, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Michael Kennedy, and Joseph Kennedy II attend Jeffrey and Courtney Kennedy's wedding in 1980. Last year, Robert Kennedy Jr. texted a photograph to a friend. In the photo, RFK Jr. was posing alongside an unidentified woman with the barbecued remains of what he suggested to the friend was a dog. Kennedy told the person who was traveling to Asia that he might enjoy a restaurant in Korea that served dog on the menu, suggesting Kennedy had sampled dog. The photo was taken in 2010, according to the digital files metadata, the same year he was diagnosed with a dead tapeworm in his brain. The picture's intent seems to have been comedic. Kennedy and his companion are pantomiming, but for the recipient, it was disturbing evidence of Kennedy's poor judgment and thoughtlessness, simultaneously mocking Korean culture, reveling in animal cruelty, and needlessly risking his reputation and that of his family. Though he did not respond to Vanity Fair after this story was published online, Kennedy said publicly that the picture is of a goat in Patagonia, contrary to what he texted his friend, and has deployed a GOAT meme. In other words, greatest of all time. Kennedy later told Snopes.com it was a lamb, not a goat. The friend says that Kennedy sent me the picture with a recommendation to visit the best dog restaurant in Seoul, so he was certainly representing that this was a dog and not a goat. In any case, it's grotesque. When Kennedy was married to his second wife, Mary Richardson, he was known to text other damning images to friends as well, of nude women. Those friends assumed Kennedy himself had taken the pictures, but they didn't know whether the subject had consented to having their genitalia photographed, let alone shared with other people. When one friend lost his phone, he panicked that somebody might discover the images. Theories about Kennedy's reckless behaviors abound. Long before it was reported, members of the family knew about the brain worm, which in court testimonies Kennedy conjectured he'd picked up from food he ate in South Asia. He said the tapeworm consumed a portion of his brain and led to protracted brain fog. But more often his family points to Kennedy's 14 years as a heroin user, which began when Kennedy was 15 and didn't end until he was 29. Kennedy has made his history of addiction part of his campaign narrative, arguing that he is more equipped to fix America's addiction problem. Critics in his family feel otherwise. One, Kennedy has circulated a report from the National Institutes of Health on the impact of long-term heroin abuse, which surmises that the damage can alter the physiology of the brain, creating long-term imbalances in neuronal and hormonal systems that are not easily reversed, and which may affect decision-making abilities, the ability to regulate behavior, and responses to stressful situations. At Harvard in the mid-1970s, Kennedy was regularly injecting speedballs, a mixture of heroin and cocaine, and became a Pied Piper to friends and family, regularly shooting up with his troubled brother David Kennedy, according to multiple friends from the era. Addiction shadowed RFK Jr. and his entourage, including his best friend Chris Bartle, through college and law school, and into his early professional life, working in the Manhattan DA's office. On one level, Kennedy's substance abuse was comprehensible. He had seen his own father murdered on the public stage, a traumatic event that altered history, haunted his family, and deepened the weight of expectation on young Bobby, who was 14 at the time. Of all Bobby Sr.'s children, the namesake son was considered the most promising dynastic heir. Square-jawed and twinkly-eyed, he looked and sounded the most like his father, with the charisma and public profile to take up the mantle if he chose. His college roommate, Peter Kaplan, the acclaimed editor of the New York Observer, who died in 2013, once noted Bobby's almost frightening facility with language. By birthright and training, Kennedy was presidential timber, with family friends like Robert Coles, a psychiatrist and professor at Harvard, and Lem Billings, a close friend of John F. Kennedy's, expending considerable effort trying to mentor and tutor him after his father's death. "Jack Kennedy was lucky," Billings once said. "He didn't have a lot of Kennedys getting there before him. Everywhere a boy like Bobby looks, there are footprints, all of them deeper than his own." Many tried and failed to get him off heroin. Instead of guiding him to greater glory, Billings followed Bobby into heroin addiction. Meantime, Kennedy looked for heroes outside the family bubble, befriending Roger Ailes, the late Fox News founder, who at the time was an independent TV producer and advisor to Richard Nixon. In 1972, when RFK Jr. was 18, Ailes took Kennedy to Kenya to shoot a wildlife documentary in which Kennedy appeared shirtless and running from a rhinoceros. Family lore had it that Kennedy, while attending Harvard, once leapt the gap between two six-story buildings. He kept an owl in his house and carried a live snake around campus. Because of the drug-taking and risky behavior, Bobby was often at odds with his mother, Ethel, who regularly threw him out of the house. Jackie Kennedy Onassis forbade her own children, John and Caroline, from fraternizing with him and his brothers. Like all the rest of us, Bobby grew up feeling that being a Kennedy, you could do virtually anything you wanted. Kennedy's cousin Chris Lawford told the authors of The Kennedys, an American drama, a controversial 1984 book. "It was good because you got away with things other people wouldn't dream of. It was bad because it destroyed your sense of what was worth doing." One of the authors, the other died in 2019, could attest to that. David Horowitz remembers Bobby being so cavalier that he cut lines of cocaine for his brother Michael Kennedy and allowed him to snort a line in front of the writer. And only then did he introduce Horowitz as a reporter. Horowitz also recalls that Kennedy asked him for a ride to Harlem to score drugs. In 1983, RFK Jr., by then an assistant DA in the office of Manhattan District Attorney Robert Morgenthau, was discovered overdosing in the bathroom of an airplane. When an excerpt of the Kennedy book was published in Playboy magazine in 1984, the family turned on David Kennedy for airing the family's addiction secrets, and he stayed in a separate hotel during a family gathering in Palm Beach. "Bobby," David had told the book's authors, "was our last illusion." The next day, David died of an overdose at age 28. After Kennedy was arrested for possession of heroin, his cousin, Michael Skakel, also a recovering addict, supported him through recovery, which Kennedy said brought them close together. He would say he knew Skakel as well as one person can know another. Skakel later became the chief suspect in the 1975 murder of 15-year-old Martha Moxley in Greenwich, Connecticut, having confessed to private investigators in the mid-1990s that on the night of the murder, he had climbed a tree near Moxley's bedroom window and masturbated. She was found the next day beaten and stabbed to death with a broken golf club. Though he was not initially a suspect, Skakel had also intimated to boarding school friends that he had committed the murder. By the late 1990s, Kennedy had found his calling as an environmental lawyer, running the nonprofit Riverkeeper, starting an environmental law firm, and leading the charge against corporate polluters, pressuring General Electric to spend $1.7 billion to clean up PCBs the company had dumped into the Hudson River. He regularly attended AA meetings, a model of recovery and renewed purpose. The other Kennedy men of his generation, however, were busy blowing up the family's legacy. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.